Welcome to Inside Medical Malpractice. This subject fascinates everyone everywhere because it affects everyone everywhere. My name is Chris Rokosch. I'm a registered nurse, legal consultant and educator, and the president of Connect Medical Legal Experts. Medical malpractice affects patients, families, nurses, doctors, midwives, healthcare institutions, the associations that define medical standards, lawyers, and the general public. Each month, we'll be looking at the malpractice issues from different perspectives, featuring honest, candid, insightful interviews by people and professionals with a wealth of information to share. Thanks for spending time with me today. Now let's dive into this fascinating subject. Hello, and welcome back. I'm here today once again for a third conversation with Paul Cahill of the law firm of Will Davidson in Toronto. Paul's been a partner in that firm since 2011, having started there as an articling student in 2004. His job is to help seriously injured people obtain compensation for their losses, whether it's by medical malpractice, car accidents, slip and fall, or product failure. He's successfully litigated both jury and non-jury cases in the Superior Court of Justice. He's appeared at both the Divisional Court and the Court of Appeal. He has represented clients at administrative boards and tribunals, including Workplace Safety and Insurance Appeals, the Health Professions Review and Appeal Board, and the CPP Review Tribunals. Sounds like you've been a busy guy, and welcome, Paul.
Hello, how are you?
I'm really well. I want to thank you so much for coming back for this third conversation. For those of you who may not have heard, steps one and two are in this series. We're going to talk today about a medical malpractice trial that Paul ran in the past year, one of only three. One of three that he ran, two of which have so far been successful, and third awaiting judgment. If you didn't catch the significance of that, I'm just going to say it one more time, is it's pretty impressive. There were only 60 malpractice trials in Canada last year, and many, many lawyers who say that their practice includes medical malpractice. And of those 60 cases that went to trial, in 2018, statistically, only 8 of them were successful for the plaintiff's lawyer. So running 3 is significant, and winning 2 and potentially 3 is pretty amazing. So congratulations to you, Paul.
Thank you, Chris.
In the first podcast, we talked about a case that the judgment is still under reserve as of today's date, which is April 10th, 2020. It was a Hakopian estate v. Mahmood. The second one, we talked about a case involving some gynecological surgery, O'Neill Renouf v. Ibrahim. And so don't miss listening to the first and second of this series because they're both fascinating and informative. And I've asked Paul to drill down some learnings for anybody who might be listening, for lawyers, for doctors, for nurses, for healthcare professionals of any kind, for the general public. So don't miss listening to those. Today, we're here to talk about the third case, which was litigated in the past 12 months, which is Woods v. Jackowitz. And I think the very interesting aspect of this is it was a trial in front of a jury. So that's going to raise some great questions and conversations with you, Paul. And I'll just let you take it away from here. Tell us about the facts of the case, the outcome for the plaintiffs, and then we'll have some questions down the road.
Absolutely. So this case was tried in Kitchener almost a year ago. I think the judgment came out almost a year ago to this day. And it was a 3-week trial in front of a jury. The case actually went back quite some time. It went all the way back to 1991, when the plaintiff, Bernice Booth was her maiden name, was pregnant with twins. And she was a young woman in her early 20s. And she sought out obstetrical care from a local obstetrician, Dr. Jackowitz, who followed her pregnancy in his office. The issue in this case that led to the litigation was that Bernice developed something called twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome. She didn't know she had twins right away, but after the first ultrasound that she had, it was determined that she had twins. And although it wasn't known right at that time, as it turns out, the twins shared a placenta. And in twins that share a placenta, they can develop an abnormality, which results in one twin receiving more blood than the other. And that can cause one of the twins to grow larger and expel more amniotic fluid, or urine that creates amniotic fluid, causing potentially compression on the smaller twin that may not develop as quickly or have as much amniotic fluid to protect itself. That's what happened in this case. The issue is the timeliness of the diagnosis and whether Dr. Jacowitz should have recognized some clinical circumstances and signs that were being presented to him in the office visits that should have necessitated a referral to a perinatologist, a maternal health obstetrician at a larger hospital, to potentially manage this condition in a way that would have offered a good outcome for the twins. As it turned out, by the time Bernice presented to hospital on her own because of her own concerns, not at the direction of her obstetrician, it was decided that she required an immediate C-section because the smaller twin was in distress. And she ended up giving birth to her twins prematurely at approximately 27 weeks.
Hmm. That's very early, especially in the 1990s.
You know? And exactly. Mm-hmm. And so one of the twins actually ended up being okay, but the other one ended up developing severe cerebral palsy. And at the time of trial, which was almost about a 28, 29-year-old woman, was completely and utterly dependent on her parents for everything. Feeding, mobility. She required diaper changes. She was effectively nonverbal. Completely dependent, and probably would be described by her parents as an adult infant.
Right.
And so...
So a sad outcome, for sure.
A tragic outcome. And the theory of the plaintiff's case, and I'll talk a little bit more about the standard of care issues, but the main theory of the case was that had Bernice been referred to a large hospital earlier, they would have diagnosed the twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome, which isn't too hard to diagnose with an ultrasound at an appropriate time because it'll show discordant growth between the fetuses. So that diagnosis likely would have been made. And treatment could have been undertaken that wasn't a C-section. So at the time that she got there, it was just so emergent that there was really no other option but to do a C-section. And had she gotten somewhere earlier when it wasn't such an emergency, then another type of treatment likely would have taken place. And that was something called an amnioreduction. Now, this is an interesting case because we go all the way back to 1991. So treatment for twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome has changed. They don't do amniorreductions anymore. They do laser therapy to actually try to correct the abnormality and in the hopes that the pregnancy can continue on to term, allowing the fetuses to fully develop. Cerebral palsy, as you know, is a major risk of prematurity, right? So in this case, what likely would have altered the outcome, at least that was the plaintiff's theory of the case, would have been some kind of an intervention that wouldn't have necessitated or would have avoided the necessity of a C-section, because it was really the C-section and the prematurity that was the cause of the cerebral palsy.
Oh, I see. So you were arguing that if the pregnancy could have safely been maintained longer, yeah, that the outcome may have been different.
Correct. And we had a pediatric neurologist testify from SickKids who presented some studies and literature and based through his own education and training. That even a 5-week extension of a pregnancy from 27 weeks to, let's say, 32 weeks offered a very, very significant improvement in outcome and a very significant reduction in incidence of cerebral palsy.
Sure, much lower rates of morbidity. Can I ask you just a quick question,
yeah,
before we go beyond this point? You said something along the lines of... the clinical signs and symptoms during this pregnancy should have prompted this physician to refer her to a larger center. And yep. then it was eventually the mother herself taking herself to the hospital because of signs and symptoms she was experiencing. Can you talk about both of those things? Like what was happening during this during this second trimester of the pregnancy? What was going on that should have A, prompted the physician to refer, and B, prompted this patient to go to the hospital, this mother to go to the hospital?
Sure. So I think probably the biggest concern was her growth. So her symphyseal fundal height, which is a measurement from your in the top of your pubis to your symphysis, which can correlate or should correlate with the gestational age in centimeters. So someone who is 27 weeks pregnant should have a symphyseal fundal height of about 27 centimeters, as I understand it. Now, that may be a little bit different for women who are pregnant, but nevertheless, at her last visit with the obstetrician, her fundal height was 40 centimeters at 27 weeks.
Oh, I see. So big discrepancy.
So she was big, mm-hmm. too big. And she was gaining weight. She was gaining a lot of weight, and she was very big. And I mean, one explanation could be that she was just getting big with big twins, or it could be that there was an excess amount of fluid in her system that needed to be looked into further. The reality is that twin detection transfusion syndrome is something that can't be diagnosed clinically in the sense that an obstetrician, I don't think, can lay their hands on a woman's belly and say, oh, I think you have twin detection transfusion syndrome. But certainly, an abnormal presentation can prompt a referral for an ultrasound. And there may have been other causes of this, but without doing an ultrasound, one wouldn't know. And that became the issue, is should an ultrasound have been performed based on the clinical presentation? There was also sort of another issue, which was, should there have just been more ultrasounds done? So mm-hmm. in this particular case, there was really only one, there were two ultrasounds done, but the real reason for the second one was because the first one wasn't completed. So there were two ultrasounds done close together, at about 20 weeks and 22 weeks right. gestation. And no more were done. And the argument that was made by the plaintiff's experts was, you know, even in 1991 with twins, which are considered a high-risk pregnancy, serial ultrasounds were required. And the interval of those may have been debatable. Is it every 2 weeks? Is it every 3 weeks? Is it every 4 weeks? Like that could be there were no SOGC guidelines in place at that time that would have dictated a particular interval in the serial ultrasound imaging of a twin mother at that time. But certainly more frequent ultrasounds than were done in this particular case were warranted. And even at a 4 week interval, this patient would have likely had another ultrasound probably about 10 days or so before she ultimately presented herself to the ER on her own volition. So there was that she should have just had an ultrasound earlier, which would have diagnosed the condition and prompted a referral. And there was this abnormal growth of her fundus that should have also, on its own, alerted the obstetrician to the necessity of a ultrasound, which would have led to the same outcome.
And what was it that prompted her to take herself to the emergency room?
She felt something was wrong. I mean, I'm trying to remember her testimony, but I think she when she presented to the ER, she had actually presented to her obstetrician 2 days before, but it was an unscheduled visit. So she presented on July the 7th on her own. She had been to her obstetrician on July the 5th, but her last standard antenatal visit was on June the 27th. And she wasn't really expected to come back, I think, for another month from that date. So she had her end of June appointment, and then she comes back in early July to see her obstetrician unscheduled because she's concerned. And at that point, there's a 4 pound weight gain in about 10 days. Mm. There's a fundal height of 40 centimeters, and the obstetrician actually does an internal examination and notes that her cervix is effacing. Mm. That's really all that's in the notes. So why did he do the internal examination? I guess he was looking for, signs of early labor.
Right.
Or something else. And so it was not a normal antenatal visit, right? To have all of that happening. But according to the plaintiff, she was told to go home and rest and watch soap operas, and her baby will be along when it's ready. Her baby will be along when it's ready. Just don't worry about it. Go home and relax.
Right.
And I don't think...
she was worried.
She was very worried.
Yeah.
And she was young. I think she was 22 at the time. A very, very young mother.
Mm-hmm.
And worried and felt like something wasn't quite right. And couldn't sleep, couldn't get comfortable, was in a tremendous amount of pain. And just took herself to hospital 2 days after that last visit.
And something prompted an ER doctor or consulting obstetrician to perform an ultrasound. Is that how this was picked up?
So she went to the local community hospital in Niagara first, and they did not do an ultrasound there. They did an examination and determined that it would be best to send her to McMaster, which was the closest tertiary care center in that region. And so she went there where an ultrasound was performed and diagnosed the twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome and also the dire situation of the smaller twin.
Right.
And the C-section was organized very quickly. And I think we're talking a matter of hours from when she got to McMaster that the C-section.
I see. So, all right. Sad stories, all of these stories. And you've talked to us about the facts of the case and the outcome. And just correct me if I'm right or wrong, your theory of the case and the allegations were surrounding delayed diagnosis based on presenting symptoms or lack of adequate, you know, diagnostic imaging and other things. Am I correct? Well, why don't I just shut up and let you tell me what was your theory of this case? And then tell me the defense position as well. And then let's get into that.
So the plaintiff's theory was that, one, this patient should have had more frequent, should have had serial ultrasounds and should have had an ultrasound in a time before she ultimately presented herself to the emergency room. And, and we know what happened from that point, the emergency C-section and premature infant and the development of cerebral palsy.
Right.
So this patient should have had her diagnosis of twin-to-twin transfusion made earlier, either because of, you know, serial ultrasounds or from an order for an ultrasound by the obstetrician based on an abnormal clinical presentation.
Right.
That would have warranted further investigation in the form of an ultrasound. So basically an earlier diagnosis.
Right.
Had she had an earlier diagnosis, she would have undergone this procedure that I was talking about briefly earlier, amnioreduction. Amnioreduction is the removal of the excess amniotic fluid to relieve the pressure on the smaller twin to allow the continuation of the pregnancy without the necessity of a C-section. Amnioreduction in 1991, and this is where the defense theory kicks into high gear. It was, according to our experts, so I had two obstetrical experts, one from Mount Sinai, one from Sunnybrook. One was here in 1991 in Ontario practicing. The other one came to Ontario in 1992. Their evidence was that amnioreduction was the standard of care of treatment for patients with twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome in Ontario, and that it was a simple procedure that pretty much any obstetrician can do. It just requires a needle. It's effectively the same thing as an amniocentesis, which is done for diagnostic purposes very frequently, and it can be quite effective. The literature on a subject, of which there's a fair bit, you know, was up and down in terms of whether it made any difference. And this is not a uncommon story for lawyers litigating medical malpractice cases, that the scientific community has clearly a different standard when it comes to analyzing outcomes. And in some cases, amnioreduction proved beneficial for prolonging pregnancy. Sometimes it didn't. And the other thing is, it was argued that amnioreduction was not really something that everyone bought into in terms of a treatment for this particular condition.
Right.
And in 1991, laser had not was not really an option, and so there wasn't really much of a treatment except for waiting and hoping that nothing goes wrong.
But your point was that unless the diagnosis was made, there could be no treatment without a diagnosis.
Well, absolutely. There's definitely no treatment without a diagnosis. But even with the diagnosis, the defense argued that amyloid reduction, the defense argument was amyloid reduction was a scientifically unproven treatment that some physicians and institutions did employ, but some didn't. And there was no specific guidelines in terms of how frequent to do the amyloid reduction and how much fluid to take. And, you know, there weren't protocols and guidelines. And the real big argument, which I think is likely why they're appealing the case. I can talk about that in a moment. But the real argument is that there is no evidence that in 1991, no direct evidence, that McMaster would have even done an amyloid reduction had she been referred there earlier. Now, the obstetricians that testified said that, well, at our institutions, we would do them. And if McMaster wouldn't do it for whatever reason, but we can't imagine why they wouldn't, because it's really easy to do, and anyone knows how to do it, and that's the only treatment that's available. So, you know, if you're going to do anything, that's what you do, and why would you do nothing when you can do something? But if they didn't want to do it, well, they could just send her to us. We'd do it. Because we work in Ontario, like other parts of Canada. We work on a referral system, and we get the patient to the treatment that they need. And sometimes we need to travel a little bit. But,
sure.
You know, the distance between Hamilton and Toronto, it's like a 20-minute ambulance ride. It's not very far.
Sure.
So that was the theory of the case on the defense side. I mean, the defense had a standard of care theory that, you know, this doctor did, you know, he was reasonable, he was prudent, he didn't need to do more ultrasounds. He didn't need to refer this patient. I don't think that was a particularly strong argument at the end of the day. I think the strongest defense argument and their best theory was this was a very unfortunate and rare event that, if you look in the literature, does cause a significant amount of mortality and morbidity amongst infants. And in 1991, there really wasn't anything in terms of treatment that was available. Yeah, there was this amyloid reduction that some people did, but we don't know if they would have done it at Hamilton, if they were even doing it in Hamilton. And even if they did do it in Hamilton, looking at the literature, we don't know if it would have made any difference. In fact, if anything, it probably wouldn't have made any difference. That was the case.
That is a case. And that seems... just listening to you talk about the two sides and what was known about what was done in 91 and what I know about twin-to-twin transfusion, I can see, you know, that that's a little mountain to overcome, or, you know, and how did you, or will you, or have you already overcome the defense argument about what would or wouldn't have been done, what would or wouldn't have been available, and the effectiveness of the intervention had it occurred?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Yeah. So this case was tried in front of a jury.
Yeah.
Which I find really interesting. Talk to us about, how common are jury trials for medical malpractice cases? And a second part of that question is, how did this one come to pass?
So medical malpractice cases before juries traditionally, I think, were rare. And when, in Ontario at least, and when you look at some of the jurisprudence on that point, you'll see a lot of cases from the 80s and the 90s where defendant physicians are successful in striking juries on the basis that medical malpractice is too complicated for them.
Right.
And it would be simply overwhelming to try to get them to understand the case in order to make a reasonable decision.
Right.
I think that sentiment has changed, and I think the courts and I think lawyers are warming up to the idea of juries, including myself, for medical malpractice cases, as well as a lot of other lawyers. And the reason is that, for starters, I don't think these medical issues are too complicated for the most part. I mean, sometimes it can be for sure, but, you know, lawyers are technically lay people too, and so are judges.
Right.
So we haven't yet moved to the point of having, you know, arbitrations done by doctors to decide medical malpractice cases. So long as they are being decided in our civil judicial system, they are being decided by lay people. And one can make an argument, and civil juries are made up of six people, by the way, so one can make an argument that putting six people together to try to figure things out might be better than putting one judge, with tasking one judge with the burden of figuring it all out by him or herself.
Right.
And collectively, six people applying common sense can hopefully come to a rational and fair decision at the end of the case.
So just a quick stop right there. I'm just interested in that comment that you just said. We haven't yet moved to the point where doctors are arbitrating or arbitrators are making decisions. What's that all about? Is that something in the
I'm
works?
Not just imagining a different world. Like if the argument is that lay people aren't equipped with the requisite skill set to decide malpractice cases,
right?
Then the only alternative would be to have these cases decided by doctors,
I see.
which we don't do here. I don't know if they do it anywhere else. It's not an impossible system that we could develop. It's probably not one that I personally endorse, but you know, the fact is that malpractice cases in Ontario and in Canada are decided either by judges and juries,
right?
Who are not medically trained, who are not medical doctors, also, you know, and they decide
right
these issues.
Well, I've been as an expert witness, not to a lot of trials, but four or five or maybe six, and it's probably been a 50-50 split for judges and juries. And it's a little different mood, and certainly as an expert, you gear your conversations, your eyesight, your approach a little bit differently. How was that for you in this particular case? Because the issues are understandable, but they're also quite complex. So how did you and your experts present yourselves and your arguments in a way that a jury could understand? And really, not just understand, but I think truly comprehend and be able to make an informed decision based on what they knew.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for starters, I like medical illustrations. I do them for judge alone cases too, but I definitely like to get medical illustrations, even if they illustrate something very simple. I find that that's helpful for juries to kind of visualize what we're talking about. So we had concept illustrations for twin-to-twin transfusion and how it works, and amnioreduction and how you measure syncytial funnel height. We had a timeline of events for the jury to look at to help them understand. I mean, my personal belief is if you can make a jury understand your case on the plaintiff side, you have a very good chance of being successful. If they're confused, they're more likely to dismiss the case because they don't understand it.
Right.
And I think I've mentioned this before. I think it's the plaintiff's job, the plaintiff's lawyer's job, to try to make the case as simple and comprehensible and digestible as possible. And it's the defense job to make it complicated and unwieldy. And impossible to understand or to accept that there's some kind of nexus between what the plaintiff is saying should have happened and would have happened.
I see.
And so I think it's a natural approach to keep things simple, but not so simple that, you know, you're insulting people's intelligence.
Of course.
You have a range of people on juries, and this is just the reality of it. So, you know, you have people from, you know, a young student. I'm just thinking about the makeup of our jury. We had three women and two men. We lost a juror on the first day due to a medical issue, so we were reduced to five jury members. I think one was a professor of something. One was a student, a grad student. One had, you know, sort of a self-employed job. I couldn't talk to any of them. I mean, it's not like a judge, you can sort of have a little exchange with a judge and the judge might ask questions. You might have a little bit of a conversation in court. You don't get to do that with a jury. The best you can get is a look.
Right.
And you know, what that look means, could be anyone's guess. I mean, if you're a somewhat intuitive person, you might be right as to what the look means, but you could be totally wrong.
Right. We all know that stink eye look on TV shows that we see.
You can get a stink eye, but there are certain things that I think you're not wrong to think. And so let's say I'm addressing the jury and they're nodding. Mm-hmm. I'm going to think that they're getting what I'm saying. Right. If you nod at me, I'm going to say, okay, you're telling me non-verbally that you understand what I'm saying.
Right.
And if you're nodding a lot, maybe you're almost saying, okay, I get it. Like, leave me alone. Like, stop telling me this thing over again. I get it.
Mm.
So, there's a lot of that where you're trying to gauge it. And because there's more than one of them, maybe one person's nodding and the other person's looking at their feet. So you got to try to figure out what that means and how you can adjust everything to make that make sense. One of the things that I certainly employ is brevity. I'm a big believer in that. And so my examinations weren't super long of my experts. I covered what I thought was important. My cross-examinations of the defense experts were not very long. And I really just tried to get to what I thought were the most important points so that I could put together a story at the end that was compelling, sensible, and appealed to both reason and justice.
Well, I just want to give you a quick shout out, Paul, because we were talking about this right before we started recording this, is in every one of these three cases, I've had a list of 25-ish questions to ask you specific details about the case. And your presentation has been so clear and complete that I've had to ask very few of those questions. You just do a great job of a simple, well-paced, well-toned, thorough explanation of what's going on. So I can see as a juror, I'm sure I'm not the only one in the world who finds that both reassuring and believable.
Thank you.
So how long, first, before we move off this issue with the jury, did having a jury versus a judge to present this case to present you with any particular challenges?
I think it's a little bit of a different approach with a jury. For starters, you want to be extra careful not to do or say something that could cause a mistrial or cause the judge to dismiss the jury. So obviously you don't want to do anything inflammatory or improper, which adds a little bit of stress because you do kind of want to be in the moment as you're presenting your case and not overly conscious about making a mistake. But having a jury there can add a certain level of stress to that. Mm-hmm. Whereas with a judge, you can ask a completely improper question. A judge will give you a dirty look and you'll be like, I'm sorry, let's move on. And it's fine, unless you're repeatedly doing it and annoying the judge. So you have a little bit more wiggle room in a judge alone trial in terms of little bit of missteps, which can happen. I mean, you get a little heated, you get a little not liking what you're hearing, and maybe you go a little too far. That can have actually very grave consequences in a jury trial.
Sure.
So there's that level of stress. The thing I really like, if we're sort of talking about what the pros and cons of jury trials, I like that. I think juries are guided by their sense of fairness and common sense and justice, and maybe a little less so on technicality. Whereas I think judges do approach things similarly, but because of their knowledge of the law and the burden on the plaintiff and the standard of care and expert requirements and all these sorts of things that I think legally need to be accounted for, which jurors don't need to account for as much, can lead to a more technical analysis of a case and may open the door for cases not dissimilar to this, where there is literature out there that says maybe the ammo reduction wouldn't have been all that helpful. And then there's evidence that it would have been, there's evidence that it wouldn't have been. And maybe that ambiguity would be sufficient for a judge to be less convinced on causation, whereas a jury may be just as convinced or more convinced based on everything, the totality of the case and what they think is fair.
Right, exactly.
So I think that offers a little bit of an advantage to plaintiffs who have sympathetic cases that on the face of them seem very justifiable.
Okay.
The other advantage to self-appointed with a jury is that they decide the case right then and there for you.
Right. Like, how long did that take? Did they deliberate for hours or days or weeks, or how long did that take?
It took them two days. So they started deliberating. What happens at the end of the case is the lawyers present their closing arguments, and then the judge does what's called a charge. The judge charges the jury. Most of the time, the lawyers will get the judge's charge ahead of time and will get an opportunity to talk to the judge about what the judge is planning to say to the jury before the judge actually says it, which is actually makes a lot of sense so that you can maybe argue for changes and have it changed before it's delivered instead of afterwards, which is obviously harder to do.
And what does that sound like, the charge to the jury in a case like this?
So usually it's a recital of the facts of the case as the judge has interpreted them or found them. Usually it's a very fair and non-partisan recital of the facts. So, you know, you heard from this doctor and he said this, but then you heard from this other doctor and he said that. And often it's very balanced, and it was, I think, in this case. And the jury is also told, well, you know, I'm not the one deciding this case. Like, the judge isn't deciding the case, the jury is. And the jury's told that it's really up to them to decide, so don't listen to me what the facts are, but here's sort of a little summary to help you out. And then the judge goes into what the law is. And most importantly, jurors are given questions to answer. So they have to answer questions, like a little question sheet that the lawyers put together. Did the defendant physician fall below the standard of care? Yes or no? And if you say yes, state your reasons. And if you answered yes to question one, did the breach of the standard of care cause harm to the plaintiff? If yes, explain. So the judge will go over and sort of explain what those questions mean and how legally to approach them. The charge can take a while. In this case, it was pretty much the whole morning and just finished after lunch. And then the jury was sequestered, meaning that they were put in a room with all the exhibits in the trial and left alone to decide the case. So they sat and deliberated until about 4:30 p.m. that first day, and they hadn't yet reached a verdict, which to me was very encouraging because I was thinking to myself, well, it doesn't take very long to say no. Because if they said no to the first question, they don't even have to answer anything else. It's you're done, right? You don't reach the standard of care, okay, fine. So I was happy that it had taken them 4 hours and they still hadn't answered the questions. Mm-hmm. Right? So I figured, well, I'm hoping they're thinking about reasons, and to think about reasons, they must have said yes to at least one of the questions. And then we came back the next day and they deliberated all day until about mid-afternoon. And finally, we got word from the court services officer that the jury had reached a verdict and were summoned back into court to hear it. And the way that it works is one of the jurors is appointed the foreperson. And sometimes they read the verdict, sometimes they just give the verdict. In this case, they gave the verdict. So they gave their written answers to these questions to the judge. And obviously, you're looking very keenly at the judge as he first looks at the written decisions, see what his reaction is.
For a clue.
Surprise or disappointment or excitement. This judge was very, very stone, poker-faced. He had no idea what he was thinking. So he looked at it and read it. And as in his mind, I could tell he was reading it, which also provided me a great sense of relief because if he was reading something more than a no, obviously it would have been a yes. Mm. And so he then read it aloud in the courtroom, and as it turns out, they found that there was a breach of the standard of care, and it did cause the harm to the infant.
Oh, boy. So, two quick questions around that. What are you and the family doing in this time, you know, from noon till 4:30 and for most of the next day while the jury's sequestered and deliberating? Where are you and the family, and how's that going?
So I had my associate lawyer there. So we were hanging out. We're hanging out with the family. We'd have lunch with them. We had to kind of stick close to the courtroom. A lot of pacing, a lot of coffee.
Emotions, you know, must be high.
Yeah, just feeling, you know, like you're going to throw up for 2 days. What can I say? It's not a great, you know, you don't.
Yeah.
You know, you're fought so hard for these people for so long, and really want more than anything for them to succeed.
Sure, of course. So you alluded in the last podcast about this moment being much more fun and exciting in the presence of a jury in a courtroom versus getting a phone call and sharing it with someone. Talk to us about this. What was this moment like?
Yeah, this is a moment I won't ever forget. Turning to my client, so the infant that developed cerebral palsy, one of her parents was in the courtroom. The other one wasn't there because she had to take care of the daughter. And his name's Michael, and he's a gem of a person, such a nice guy. And he sat through the whole trial and always gave supportive, positive feedback. And even before the verdict was read, I looked back at him, and tears were welling in his eyes. And it was just a very emotional moment to have that decision come down in his favor, in the family's favor. That some of the jurors were visibly emotional as well. Mm-hmm. And we basically turned around and we gave him a big hug.
Mm. Isn't right. that something? Now, you mentioned, congratulations to all of you. But you mentioned that this case is currently under appeal.
Yes.
Yes. Tell us about that.
It's under appeal. It is supposed to be heard May 21st in the Ontario Court of Appeal. I'm hoping it does proceed. The defendant physician appealed only on the issue of causation. So there's no, as far as I know, no appeal on the finding that there is a breach of the standard of care. To simplify the appeal, they're basically saying that there was no evidence that the procedure of amniorotation was available at Hamilton McMaster Hospital in Hamilton. And because of a lack of that evidence, the jury had no basis to make the finding that they made. Therefore, the case should be dismissed. And they're effectively saying that the plaintiff, amongst other things, that the plaintiff ought to have led evidence from obstetricians working in McMaster, at McMaster in 1991, to come and say that they would have performed amniorotation therapy on this patient had they been referred earlier. Whether that is necessary for a plaintiff to succeed or not, or whether or not there was good, compelling evidence to say that this patient would have received this treatment one way or another, somewhere, had she been diagnosed earlier. That's really the issue before the court of appeal. But coming up soon. Hopefully, I think because of the pandemic, there may be some scheduling issues, but we're hoping that it'll get determined just 5 weeks from now.
Yeah. Oh, well, I hope so. I hope so. And do you have a sense? Do you have a sense of how that's going to go?
I don't know. I mean, I do know that jury verdicts are given a lot of deference from appellate courts.
Yes.
It's not... The law is pretty clear that, you know, unless the jury's verdict is perverse or not founded on the facts, it's not really the job of appellate courts to come in and reconsider the case and come to a better decision.
Right.
The reality is that there's a lot of facts in any kind of case, and the jury has to sift through them all and pick out the facts that they think are most convincing and compelling in arriving at a decision that they think is fair and just. Mm-hmm. And so long as they've done that in a rational way, based on evidence, both direct and inferred, it's not really for the Court of Appeal to interfere with that. And so historically, jury verdicts are very hard to overturn on appeal in a civil case.
Yes.
So I think, you know, just looking at it abstractly, it is more of an uphill battle, I think. But you never know what can happen.
Sure. Well, good luck. I hope for the best. So we'll wrap this up within a few more questions. I could talk about this all day, and your presentation of this story is fascinating to me, and I'm sure a lot of other people. But one question that I would like to bring up for people who may have questions about it is the statute of limitations. It's rare that you talk about a child. You said this this young woman was 28 at the time that she appeared at the trial. So how does it happen that a case from 1991 is just in trial last year?
So, yeah, so the case was started, I think, before her 20th birthday. But that still adds another 8 years onto
sure.
the case. Yeah, so the statute of limitations against minors don't run until they turn 18. Mm-hmm. So people have those 18 years, and then as the law currently stands, an additional 2 years until they're 20 to start a case. You could have even argued that she had an even longer limitation period by nature of her disability. But we weren't retained, shortly after this and waited 30 years to bring it to court. We were retained close to her 20th birthday. And the reason why, I think, and it's not uncommon that in these, what we might call a compromised baby case, the parents present later to lawyers, is firstly, you don't really know when the baby is first born, how bad is it going to be? You're aware that there's some developmental delay, there's some disability, but you hope and pray that your child grows up to be independent and self-sufficient, and you don't need to hire a lawyer. You don't even need to worry about any of that. And so you don't sometimes know the extent of the disability until the person becomes older. The other thing, I think, is the reality sets in at some point for a parent of a child with a disability that I'm not going to be able to care for this person for the duration of their life.
Right.
I am going to probably either become unable, or I'm going to become unable to care for this person either because I'll be too old or I'll be dead. I don't want to see my disabled child in one of those places that she's warehoused until she dies. I want her cared for in a better environment, and that requires a lot of money. And there's no way I'm going to get that money unless I bring a lawsuit. And so maybe I should talk to a lawyer and see, could this have been prevented, and am I entitled to some compensation that could afford the kind of care that I'd want for my child when I can't care for her anymore?
Sure.
So I think those are the two factors that probably bring people a little bit late. Some people come early, I do get consulted, child's 6 months old or 2 years old or 5 years old. Some, the child's 16, 18 years old.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So you've mentioned a little bit about money to support the child in the future. What can you tell us, and I understand this is another case where the damages had been decided on prior to the trial. What can you tell us about the damages in this case?
Yeah, so the damages were settled, and the amount is in the public, and it's an $11.5 million damages case, and that's comprised of primarily care costs. So the cost of caring for the disabled child and now adult, or the duration of her life.
Right, and when you talk about care costs, can you expand?
Yeah, so as a matter of law, no one expects a parent to have to constantly supervise and tend to a disabled child, adult child, or even a disabled child over and above the normal parental responsibilities that someone might have. And the obligation to pay that difference will rest at the feet of the defendant. So that would include, supervision, the attendant care, all of those sorts of things that one would be required to provide with someone with such a profound disability.
And am I right to assume, when you described a wheelchair and diapers and feeding and other things, when she appeared in court, this young woman is someone who required round the clock professional care?
Yeah, exactly.
Or some
she
version
required
of that.
Round the clock. Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. And all the costs associated with that.
So that's where that all adds up. Because it's certainly, I'm sure to the general public, this sounds like a tremendous amount of money without knowing exactly how that money is spent or will be used in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. And waiting for the appeal decision. So we'll sit tight on that and perhaps check it back in with you in a few weeks or months as this all plays out to see what happened. So I ask you this same set of questions for both of the, about the, both of the previous trials in the other two podcasts. But for all of us to learn something from this, to not be frightened again, to bring out that this was not a common event, twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome with a poor outcome. This is not an everyday thing. And no. Obstetrical care and perinatal care has changed so dramatically since the 1990s. Yes. And the age of viability has changed so dramatically. A 27-week infant is now cared for with a different survival and morbidity rate than there was in the 1990s, for sure.
Yes.
But what is there for us to learn from this? And let's take this first of all for lawyers. What advice do you have? What was the biggest learning out of this for you that you can share with lawyers?
Yeah, I mean, I think, it's obviously a very fact-specific case. And going back to 1991 can be challenging in dealing with these older cases. I mean, I think one of the obvious points, but one can't forget about, is the need to find experts that knew what the standard of care was in 1991.
Right.
And make sure that they can explain the differences between what was happening in 1991 and maybe what's happening now. There's an obvious challenge, right, in going back that far that
yes.
Can't be lost or forgotten. And it causes a lot of vulnerability in terms of where the defense can make gains if you don't have that right kind of evidence.
Sure. Well, that's real, and that was a challenge for you, I understand.
It was. No, I found it very challenging. And I think both challenging and disappointing was the fact that the treatment of this particular condition had improved so much over time.
Yeah.
And that's just the nature of how it was. But, and as you mentioned, the outcomes for premature infants improved a lot.
Sure.
That time too. So it was unfortunate that this person was born when she was born in some ways. But in a way, that also helps the defense. But I think, that was sort of a sad reality to hear, it was only 7 years later. Could have had a procedure that would have corrected the abnormality.
Exactly. Dealt with it in a whole different way. Of course.
Totally, yeah, exactly.
Okay. And what about for doctors?
Yeah, I mean, I think, one of the issues in this case, and, this is something that I'm sure doctors are always told about. One of the issues in this case was the quality of the notes. They weren't very good.
Mm.
And at least that's what my expert said. They weren't very good. They weren't very detailed. And that can always become a problem for a doctor who's facing litigation. Because they're the ones who are professionally responsible for documenting what happened at that visit. It's not the patient's responsibility to document what happened. It's the doctor's. And they're professional note takers. And they know, what's important and what's not. And they should include what's important in a way that is legible and understandable for people who are reviewing it later for legal purposes, or even for, another consulting physician needs to look at the notes for their own formulation of treatment, diagnosis, and so on. So note-taking is very important, and some physicians take really good detailed notes, and some don't.
Hmm.
And when you don't, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you didn't provide good treatments or anything like that, but it raises a question mark. What happened?
Mm.
And when we know something went wrong and your notes aren't very good, it's not hard for someone to connect the dots in a way that doesn't turn out very good for the physician. So I think that good quality note-taking can not only just help a physician when facing a lawsuit, but it can probably just stop them from happening.
Mm.
Right?
Sure.
Because if the notes are good and point to a scenario where there's nothing untoward that happened in the encounter,
right?
There may just not be a lawsuit to begin with.
Sure. Yeah, if the care decisions are justified. So did this defendant physician testify in this trial, and did the note-taking present a challenge?
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things that came up, and I don't know if it really mattered a lot, but, you know, in the antenatal record, there's a section for blood pressure.
Yep.
And this lady had 5 or 6 visits during the course of her pregnancy, and her blood pressure was always the exact same. It was recorded exactly the same. I think it was whatever your standard blood pressure is, 120 over 80. It was 120 over 80 every single time.
Mm, I see. Which raised a question.
One of our experts said, well, that's
highly
unlikely that you have exactly the same blood pressure each and every time.
Right.
And maybe he was rounding up or down, you know, I don't know. And maybe that's okay, maybe it's not okay. I don't know. But I know that the jury thought it was a way of taking a shortcut. And either he wasn't taking the blood pressure, or he wasn't really recording it accurately or whatever. But it was just sort of it could have been inferred by the jury as some kind of
credibility shortcut. Issue.
Yeah, and maybe credibility or whatever. So I think that, you know, that was one aspect of the note-taking that might have left sort of a bad taste in the jury's mouth.
Sure. Well, I know that from reviewing medical records myself. Sometimes it's the fetal heart rate that will be the same until it just isn't, you know, till someone comes in and actually takes a really good look.
And yeah, it's hard to reconcile that sometimes.
It is. It's tough to reconcile that. And these vital signs are all so variable on any given moment. But so there's a lesson for the healthcare professionals out there about note-taking and the accuracy of your documentation, for sure. And how about, was there anything you would have to say to the general public that could be learned from the events or outcome of this trial?
I mean, I think, you know, when we're talking specifically about birth outcomes that are not good, they're so significant. The impact on the family is so significant. I don't think there's anything wrong with talking to a lawyer about it. And I can assure you and members of the public that people who practice in this area, we're not looking to create lawsuits. We know how hard it is, and we're, you know, not trying to make something out of nothing. But when you do have a bad outcome, there is a very heavy financial cost to pay. And there's nothing wrong with talking to someone who practices in this area to see if maybe there's something that should be litigated for all the reasons we've talked about.
Right, exactly. And in one of the other podcasts, we talked about that a little bit in more detail about how, you know, what constitutes a case with merit and how the case is vetted and, you know, how lawyers make decisions about whether or not to take a case forward. But we also, you know, it's certainly been brought up that the number of malpractice cases that are litigated versus the number of serious medical errors in all areas of healthcare, particularly, you know, birth trauma, birth outcomes, is somewhat disproportionate. And I, like you, would never want to see a great degree of lawsuits, but certainly I appreciate that you said that the phone call will cause no harm and maybe put minds at ease or maybe move a, you know, viable case forward.
Absolutely.
So, anything else you want to tell us? I mean, this is your last podcast, Paul.
Covered it all.
Okay. this is the third out of three interviews with Paul Cahill from Will Davidson in Toronto. And again, if you're a lawyer who has a case you'd like to discuss, or a patient who has questions about the medical care that you'd like to talk to Paul about, he is easy to find as a partner of Will Davidson in Toronto. So I just want to say thank you so much, Paul. Every single one of these stories has been beautifully told and I hope perfectly understood and brought both insight and lessons and new knowledge to people listening in. So 1,000 thanks, and I hope to talk to you again sometime in the future.
Thank you, Chris. It's been my pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.